Hello, I'm Dr. Rosario Griffin, and this is an interview with Dr. Pearse McInerney, who is a lecturer in the School of Geography at UCC and is also a former diplomat in the government departments of foreign affairs. We will discuss the emergence of the alt-right in Irish politics in recent times. Hello, Pearse, you're very welcome to the show.
Hello, very nice to be here again.
Pearse, you have a particular interest in the emergence of the alt-right in recent times in Irish politics. Can you give us a little bit of background into it, please?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that it's not confined to Ireland. If you look across the world right now, we're seeing a certain amount of breakdown in trust of the normal systems of democracy and decision-making and the views of scientists and experts of various kinds and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, a lot of people just don't believe them anymore. And you now have a new way of spreading these kinds of messages of doubt called social media. I mean, the internet in many ways has changed these kind of things. It's not completely new, because even if you go all the way back to the Middle Ages, you always had these crazy preachers who could always persuade a minority of people to follow them and charge out into the hills or whatever and follow some mad dream of their own. But
yes,
Nowadays it happens on social media, and you get the most crazy conspiracy theories circulating around the world, and they have an extraordinary currency and they move extraordinarily quickly, and they all have a very similar pattern, and they tend to focus on particular processes of demonization of particular people. So we hear, for instance, that this pandemic that we're living through at the moment is actually a plandemic, if you please, that was all designed by dark forces in China or Bill Gates' office or some other person who's demonized as the head of the whole thing. And it's a form of conspiracism which actually has grown quite a lot in recent years. And so it's not just an Irish thing.
Yes, and I have to say I got a number of these clips sent to me, ironically enough, by here what I would have considered relatively normal people, so I was surprised in getting a number of these clips sent to me. And so we'll say the alt-right then, they have emerged. For instance, we had a situation in Ireland where with the lockdown we had Gemma O'Doherty and John Waters bringing an action against the government that they said that the lockdown was unconstitutional. Did you think they had a good case, or did you think it was motivated by ulterior motives?
See, part of the problem here is that if you consider a crisis like we're living through at the moment, and it's something which none of us has ever seen in our lifetime before.
Yes.
No one saw this coming, and it has had an extraordinary effect, and it has affected every part of our lives. And naturally, when the government responds to a crisis like that, there is an issue about the extent to which it must, for reasons of the public good, intrude on our normal civil liberties.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just, you know, if you were over 70, you weren't supposed to leave your house, and that was an arguable one, I think.
Yes.
The fact that all of us are bound on a daily basis to restrict our movements in various ways, and social distancing and all that kind of thing, it is an imposition on civil liberty. And in this case, the government had to make a reasoned decision based on scientific advice and the mm-hmm. best kind of expert views they could get as to how to handle this. And they did it in the light of full legal advice, which would have come, for instance, to the government from the Attorney General's office, and
yes,
they satisfied themselves that both the Dáil and the government itself was entitled to legislate for our better good. And they also managed, I think, to bring people with them. I mean, it was very effective, I think, communications here, compared to across the water, for instance, where Boris Johnson has made a completely chaotic mess of things.
Mm-hmm.
But there were people who chose to challenge this, and I don't believe it was any legal basis at all, and the judge made it very clear when he threw out Gemma O'Doherty and John Waters' case. He didn't even allow the case to proceed because he said they hadn't made one.
Yes.
And he was very clear, they brought no evidence, they called no witnesses. It was a completely mischievous case. And I'm looking right now as we speak at a post which was put up today by one of those individuals, by Gemma O'Doherty, and it says, "The purpose of COVID-19 is to usher in the final phase of the New World Order's global dictatorship. Everyone who's awake to this has a duty to share the truth widely with others." We're still going along with the pandemic, and that's one of their favourite words. She also has a posting which tells us that we have to end the tyranny or submit to fascist global governments. This is crazy stuff. The only puzzling thing for me is how people believe it at all, because these people are manifestly either demented, and I'm not able to pronounce on that, or else they're pursuing some particularly evil agenda of their own. Mm. There is no sense in it. There are no facts behind it. There is no truth in it. It's absolutely mischievous, and it seems to be upsetting a small minority of people. And I think we have to get this very clear here. The date stood for elections, people representing these various points of view, and they have, in all cases, received a derisory vote. And we saw it again earlier this year, and we saw it last year as well.
So yeah, now the party is the Irish National Party, is that right?
Well, no, there are actually several different parties.
And, right.
And one of the amusing things is that there are so few of them, and they spend their time fighting so much. So you've got the Irish National Party, that's
yes.
led by a gentleman called Justin Barrett.
Right.
And his number two is James Reynolds. Then you have the Anti-Corruption Ireland, it's called. That's led by Gemma O'Doherty. No one knows what their membership is. It's undoubtedly tiny. And they have stood, as I say, for election here and there. And there are various other individuals of more or less the same mindset. But whenever they put themselves forward for election, and it happened in the European elections last year, in the local elections, and now in the general election this year, in all cases they've received a derisory vote. So ordinary people have made their minds up.
Yes.
There's no time for this at all. What's interesting is that they seem to have a life of their own, but that life is lived mainly on the internet.
Right.
And it's a place where you have all of these extraordinary conspiracy theorists, and they all echo each other. So
mm-hmm.
Doherty, for instance, is always spreading stuff that comes from the United States or from the UK or from somewhere else. They seem to have no ideas of their own, and it's absolutely lunatic, the kind of things that they spread. So I don't think people take them seriously. The only... slightly worrisome thing is that there are people who don't know the facts and are inclined to take this in and to take it seriously.
Yes.
So we're told, for instance, that COVID-19 isn't real, or that it's a hoax, or that it was invented in a laboratory, or a favourite one is that it's part of this vast conspiracy, which is all about replacing the population of Ireland and various other parts of Europe with invaders, Muslims and Africans and various other people, and they are always demonised in this kind of way,
mm.
that they're going to replace the indigenous population of Ireland. So there is an explicitly racist content to it as well.
Mm-hmm.
But it's part of that broader lunatic vision of the world, which I suppose is more of interest, I think, to a psychologist than to a politician, because that's really
Indeed.
The proper place to look for an explanation. It's not normal politics.
Yes. One of the clips I was sent that was sent to me, which was rather convincing initially until I began to delve deeper, it worried me because I wondered how many people would delve deeper into it, was this, I don't know if you come across it, Dr. Dolores Cahill. Yes.
Academic in UCD.
Yes, who has been informing, I think, the Irish National Party and is a member of, a chairperson of it, I believe. And her views, because she seemed to have a pretty good scientific background, so it's quite convincing. And yet she was one of these people promoting the use of hydrochloric, whatever it was that Trump...
Hydroxychloroquine.
Yes, yeah. that Trump endorsed. What do you make of people like that?
It's not actually the Irish National Party that she belongs to.
Okay.
She belongs to another grouplet. This one is called the Irish Freedom Party.
Yes, the Irish Freedom Party.
Years ago, they were calling themselves the Irexit Party because it's headed by a certain Herman Kelly. And the last time he had a job was when he was working in the European Parliament on behalf of a certain Nigel Farage.
Okay.
So there is a pattern here. So the Irish Freedom Party consists for the most part of people on the far right of Irish politics.
Okay.
I wouldn't hesitate to call them a xenophobic party.
Right.
Their main agenda is to force Ireland out of the European Union, something which fewer than 10% of the population wants to do. And they have installed this person as chairwoman of the party, or mm-hmm. the person of the party, Dolores Cahill. She has been given interviews in the last 2 weeks. I'm not a scientist, so I'm not going to
yes.
do directly what she is saying.
Yes.
But I think it does not go with the consensus in terms of her views on issues like vaccines. That's another thing, by the way, with these people. They're all anti-vaccine.
Yes.
And again, nobody would say that, you know, you don't have to test vaccines thoroughly. But there is an agenda there as well, and that's part of the Bill Gates thing. For some reason, he's the new demon figure. It used to be George Soros,
yes.
who not by coincidence is Jewish. And there is a strong current of anti-Semitism as well running through some of the beliefs of these people. I'm not saying the people that we just mentioned now.
Yes.
It's an undercurrent in the movement more generally.
Isn't the worry, though, in all of these people is that they sowed the seeds of doubt in people's minds? Isn't that the fear that they... And they also... they also thrive on fear, people's fears as well. That's what makes them dangerous, isn't it?
I think it makes them very dangerous in that sense. And yes, they do sow doubt, especially when you have somebody who, on the face of it, sounds quite plausible and have an academic background, as one of these people has.
Yes.
Or a person who represents herself as being a former journalist. She was a journalist. Mm-hmm. I don't think what she does now is journalism.
Yes.
You have a similar case with the person who took the case to the High Court with her.
Yes.
In his own time, he has written very sensible and interesting and provocative things.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's not simple. I mean, all I can say is that we should be able to form our own views, but based on a considered judgment of what people have to say who are scientifically informed. I think politicians as well, whether one likes them or not, or whether you're left or right, they're not lunatics. They're not part of some vast conspiracy to enslave us. And it's really a question of looking at what lies behind the agenda being pushed by these people, so that even when they sound plausible, what they're actually driving at is not plausible at all.
Yes. Now, I suppose switching back to COVID-19 and the lockdown, do you think at this point where Ireland is becoming a little bit overly cautious in terms of starting the economy back up again? I'm just wondering, in the light of we have crushed the curve, thankfully, and the R factor is very low, the R rate of transmission.
It is, and yesterday we had no deaths at all. Today there were 9, but they were probably being reported, you know, a day or two after they occurred and so on. Well, I think the first thing to say is that the absolute imperative last March, it seems so long ago now, doesn't it?
Yes, amazing.
Paris was, you know, we had to make sure that the growth of cases, and in particular of serious cases which required ICU treatment, that didn't
escalate,
grow faster than our ability, our capacity to deal with people. And we have succeeded in doing that. There was no point here in the last couple of months when we got anywhere near reaching capacity with the ICU availability. And that was a huge achievement.
A huge achievement, yes.
Take credit for that. You know?
Agreed.
We also can see in other countries that if you lighten things up too quickly, there is a danger of a resurgence in cases, because it is transmitted within the community for the most part at this point. So I think the government has been right to be very cautious. That said, it's easy for me to say that. I've got a permanent job and I'm working from home. And all of us are working very hard, but there are people who've lost their jobs, of course. And there will be a balance of judgments to be made about how do you manage to move towards getting the economy working again, while at the same time not endangering lives. And I think in particular, these kind of weasel words like people with underlying conditions or the over 70s, there were mistakes made, and the biggest ones were made concerning nursing homes.
Yes.
We've learned a lot from that now, and the worst thing we could do would be to rush back in a precipitous fashion. But yes, I mean, we do have to move towards getting the economy going again, however slowly. And it's possible that the caution that's been exercised up to now will have to be modified a little bit the next while. I'm not qualified to speak about this 1 metre versus 2 metres argument.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a little bit suspicious of the anxiety of certain interest groups to say, well, 1 metre is fine. And, you know, suddenly we're going to move away from what has been the norm up to now. I think we have to trust the experts. And we have a very effective team leading that. And it's been great to see people that we normally don't think a lot of. The HSE has got a kicking more than once over the years, and sometimes they deserve it.
Mm-hmm.
But on this occasion, we do have a considerable degree of consensus. And I think from that point of view, one has to take it seriously. But yes, the hope must be that as the rate falls, and it really has now in the last few weeks, that we can move towards opening the economy up again. At the same time, there is a fear that come the winter, things could return. And there is a precedent there, Rosary, because if you go back to the Spanish flu, to the First World War, the first round of it was not that serious.
Okay.
The real damage occurred the second time round, when it came back with increased velocity the following winter.
Right.
And there were substantial numbers of people who died in Ireland as a result of that outbreak of Spanish flu.
Okay.
So we just have to hope and try and get the balance right. I don't think it's a question of either side being right or wrong. It's super cautious about everything. You'd have to say, well, let's keep the economy locked down indefinitely. But we can't do that.
We can't afford to do that, no.
No. And people, in the end, there are other costs as well. There are the people who aren't getting the treatment which they need for non-COVID-19 conditions.
Yes.
there are people with children, small children at home, and God help them, it must be very tough. And I think it's very tough, especially on young people who are just coming out of schools and universities and finishing their apprenticeships and so on. And normally they go into the workplace, go into they start their working lives, and everything is on hold.
Mm-hmm.
It's easier, I think, for someone my age. But I think there are people who really have suffered a lot in the last few months.
And yes,
one has to think of that as well.
Yes, indeed. And I'm afraid I'm one of those people in favour of reducing it to 1 meter, simply because I feel capacity in restaurants and bars might make their business model more sustainable going forward. But again, as you said, that's for the experts probably to decide upon.
As you know, we're looking at this as well in UCC.
Yes.
It's hugely challenging because, to give one example, a very simple one, a lecture theatre that can hold 60 people, which is quite small by our standards,
mm-hmm.
Could only hold 16 people with the new rules, if you apply the 2 metre rule.
Mm.
And really, it's impossible to see how we can cope with this if that was to be continued all through next year, for instance. So
yes.
We're doing a lot more teaching online as well, but it's not the same thing as in a classroom. And it's not the same thing either as the kind of intellectual and social and other parts of life that students want to experience. And I think that applies to people's lives generally, whether it's going into a restaurant or a pub or anything else. So I hope you're right that the 1 meter can be regarded as something that's safe to go with.
Yes, it would be good, I think, to look at the successful countries like Taiwan or Hong Kong or Singapore, and those that were very successful in curbing the virus, but also in maintaining a certain level of economic activity. And certainly they're all back up and running now. So
two little examples. My daughter lives in Wellington, in New Zealand. And if anyone has got this right from the beginning, it's been the Prime Minister of New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern.
She's amazing.
Woman.
Mm-hmm.
She's given true leadership, and they have now got through the worst of it. They've had very few deaths. I think the figure is 21.
Amazing. And, for a population equivalent,
So, I mean, there's hope there. The other place that I'm slightly aware of, because I've been talking to somebody there, is Sri Lanka.
Right.
And they have the lowest number of deaths of all. But they've done it effectively through a military curfew and a level of deprivation of liberty, which we wouldn't accept here.
Yes, well, that's the other side of it.
But I think New Zealand is a sign to the rest of us. It can be done, and they're now moving back towards normality.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe not that. It won't be just a return to what was there before. I think we have to accept that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and as you said,
quite a long time to work that out.
Yes, and it will be disappointing for people who've had to postpone weddings and all sorts of things. My own daughter would have been leaving sixth class and, you know, the end of year events.
And that's a big deal.
It is a big deal, and going into first year, and hopefully things will have resorted to some kind of normality, or indeed, as you said yourself, students returning or going into college for the first time will want to experience, you know, the joys of the freedom of third level. So,
as you know, my own father died at the beginning of April.
My condolences.
It was a very sad occasion, because the funeral was unlike any normal Irish funeral. It's a great reassurance in having neighbours and extended family and friends come to the funeral. It's a big deal in Ireland.
It's
kind of a social ritual, and it gives consolation, I think, to all those who've just lost somebody.
Mm.
And in this case, there were seven of us in the church, and my own mother, who's in a nursing home, couldn't come, because she couldn't have gone back to it if she had come.
Yes.
She had to watch it, streamed on the internet. And that was so unlike the normal ceremony of a funeral in Ireland, which is such a big social ritual.
It is.
I think it was very, very hard on a lot of people the last 12. But there was no choice, though. And I think in her case, the nursing home was right. It was one of those nursing homes that didn't get COVID-19.
Mm-hmm.
So they managed as well. But it has been very, very tough.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there will be psychological consequences for a long time for a lot of us.
Yes.
And we shouldn't underrate that either. I think it's not really being spoken of at the moment.
Yes.
But it has been very, very stressful.
Yes, and my condolences, Pyrrhus. It was a very difficult time to lose anybody. Any time, it's a difficult time to lose a parent, but especially during COVID-19
era.
So on that note, I hope things will look up in the autumn and that we will get resume to some level of normality and I suppose hopefully this virus, which has taught us a lot about ourselves, our modus operandi, our way of living, and also has been, I suppose, to have a silver lining, has not been that bad for the environment either. So there has been some,
it's
perhaps,
the environment, and also
upfronts.
It's brought out a huge degree of social solidarity with people have been nice to each other, and it's just been very encouraging as well. There's been a rediscovery of all of that, and I think we should not listen to the nutcases. I think there is a real consensus here.
Yes,
we need to stick with it. That would be my worry, that people would just say, well, everything's fine now, let's just go back to the way we were before.
Yeah.
We have to ease ourselves back in, I think.
Yes, yes. And on that cautionary note, for a cautionary tale, Pyrrhus, thank you so much for taking our call this evening.
Indeed, Rosario.
I'm delighted to talk to you, and again, our condolences on the loss of your father at this difficult time.
Many thanks.
Thank you.
Bye, Rosario.
Bye. And there you are listening to Dr. Pyrrhus McHenry, who is a lecturer in the School of Geography at UCC and is also a former diplomat from the Department of Foreign Affairs, the government departments. This interview can be listened to on www.cry104fm.com. Go to podcasts and click on Dr. Rosario Griffin, Presenter Podcasts.